I've been recording these and trying to get them onto my blog, which is at the bottom, gospelapologetics.com. But I'm only running about 6 months behind, so I apologize. Although Tony has been kind enough to put them on his server as well and sends out an email from time to time about that. So,
I'm way behind.
Well, that's all right. That's okay. So we're going to be talking today a little bit about work, okay, and in a sense, ambition and grace. And there's actually a little bit of tension because if you were going to say, you know, if you're going to recognize, the Bible tells us we are to work from the very beginning, chapter 3 of Genesis, when it, or 2, where it talks about the eviction from the Garden of Eden and the fact that that man is to work by the sweat of his brow, and the other aspects of the curse of being thrown out of the Garden of Eden, being thrown out of being an intimate friendship and in intimate relationship with God at a very personal level. But we're told to work. And then throughout the Bible, very often in Proverbs, certainly in the New Testament, if a person does not work, then what? Neither let him eat or she'll not eat. And so there is this requirement. It's actually, you know, we're actually wired. We're hardwired to work. I think I mentioned, maybe not, but last summer or last fall, Nancy and I were just taking a day off, and a couple days off, and we were sitting at a balcony at a hotel that looks out over the beach, and we were watching, it was summer, because we were watching families come to the beach, and you know, they come to the beach, all excited kids splash around the water, everything else, and you could almost time it. It was about 17 and a half minutes before they start digging. Have you ever noticed that? Digging and digging in the beach and and pretty soon the dad's down there and he's going to have the biggest sandcastle and ditch of with the moat around of all, you know. He's digging. They're all digging. They're working. I think you're at the beach.
What were we doing?
Well, we were relaxing. Look, this is how it's done, see? You sit. You watch. But that's how we are. We can't be bored. You know, the hobbies that people have become work. I think, which hobby is the most work? Golf? Would that be the most work? Probably. You know, we take on these hobbies and we turn them into work. Sailing is work. You know, having a place up north is work. You know, we take on work. So we're hardwired to work. And we have this, but we have this sense that what we have to eat, what we have to wear, the things that we acquire, the things we're able to have, we also have a sense that that's grace. So starting out, the question might be, if you were going to say, think of you know, just the nice breakfast we had this morning and the coffee and the fact that we're here, we're all wearing clothes. Most of us came here in a car of some kind, some walk, some ride with others. But we have material blessings. And the question is, and we've worked. I mean, most everybody here is in some way or another working, even if you're, you know, in a holding pattern from actual employment, we're working at stuff. So what we have, what percentage of it do we attribute to work versus grace? Because we work, so there's some of it, because if you don't work, you know, you lose out. I mean, that's just the way the system works. So of that what you have, how much would you say of it comes from work and how much of it comes from grace? Who would say, okay, go ahead, give me. So we got a vote on 100% grace.
Says, and there's a quote, I can't remember what it was from Deuteronomy numbers, that says, it's the Lord your God who gives you the ability to produce wealth.
Okay. So you're talking about the ability. But there is a certain willfulness on our part. There's a certain intentionality, a certain decision to get up and, you know, in Proverbs, get out of the sack, you know. What is it, like a hinge, a rusty hinge, is the sluggard turning in his bed. That's what it says. So there's a certain get up out of the sack and go do something. And so we have a percentage. If you were going to give us a percentage for the intentionality, the willfulness, the self-direction, what percentage would you give ourselves? Above 10%? We got a 10% over here. Okay. How about 50-50? Anybody going for 50-50? No? Sounds like a raffle. And here's the odd part of it. The odd part of it is that in order to work, we have to have a certain amount of drive, a certain amount of ambition. Have you ever known somebody who, for whom it's all drive, all ambition, all work, all the time? It's the work channel. All work, all the time. How many have known people like that? Most of us have known people like that. How many know people that's the opposite? Yeah, okay. We've all known people like that. Or at least that's the impression we get. You know, we don't know their circumstances fully. We don't know what's holding them back. Yeah. Gets the urge to work, lie down until it goes away. Excellent. Or that bumper sticker you've always all seen, work fascinates me, right? I can sit and watch forever, you know. So the more appreciative that we are of grace, does that, in terms of working and working and working, the more we appreciate grace, does that slow down our ambition, or does it propel our ambition to work? Oh, that's a good question. Yeah.
I think it propels us because okay. The more you realize what you've been given, the more you realize what you've been given.
Okay. The more you've been given, the more you have a sense of, in a sense, gratitude, dependence, response. You have a sense to respond to all that's been given to me. Yeah, John.
I think that's the proper response, but I don't think everyone responds that way.
Okay.
I think there are people who actually go the opposite.
All right. Now, how would that happen? In other words, if let's say you take a workaholic whose idol is work, okay, and all of a sudden they become regenerated, they become a follower of Christ, and that work idol, there is less of me or less of my work and more of thee. Does that back them off of that 65-hour work week? Some say no. Should maybe. Let's put it this way. If they discover the grace and the gift of a day of rest, well, at least they're down to 6 days instead of seven. So there is, even in God's law, there is some, hey, dial it back, buddy. You're killing yourself here. I mean, you could almost, God, there's almost a New York, Brooklyn accent in the Sabbath, you know. You're killing yourself. Take a rest. So there is, in some sense, a clearer sense of purpose. And from that, we get a clearer sense of God's call upon our lives. And that propels us into action. That's the line that goes this way. The line that goes this way is talking strictly at the menial side of work and realizing, you know what, I need to first of all obey God and set aside a day where I'm, that's holy day. It's a holy, it's separated day, and take a fresh look at life and my relationship with God. But you say it doesn't always happen that way.
I think not. I think they still work the same amount of hours.
Okay.
But it transfers from their work to
okay.
their work.
It's like a DVD. It's time shifting. Welcome. There's a seat right over here. Claire, we saved you a seat, Claire, right here, right where you can't miss anything.
Neil's too
dense. Wonderful. Welcome. Thank you. Welcome. So we're talking about work, Claire. So with that kind of as a backdrop, let's take a look at Ecclesiastes 5, and we're looking at verses 8 to 20. We looked at the first seven verses last week. And before we do that, if you have your handout, and everybody should have a handout, make sure everybody around you has a handout, please. And also make sure all the yellow bookmarks have been claimed, please, so that when I shout them out unannounced, you'll be ready to read a Bible verse right off the bat. But on the handout, we have our memory verse, which are the last two verses of the book of Ecclesiastes. Easy to remember, Ecclesiastes 12, 13, 14. Let's read it together, and actually in a couple weeks, I'll be gone, Nancy and I'll be gone next week, but when I get back, we're going to actually start doing memory. It's only two verses, but let's read it together today. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. And last week we spent a fair amount of time talking about fear. Today we're talking about the vanity of wealth and honor. So take a look at Ecclesiastes 5, and starting at verse 8. And verses 8 to 12, if you look at the outline, and that's actually set up for you to take some notes if you'd care to. Look at verses 8 to 12, and let me just read them. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, don't be amazed at the matter, for the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. So right there, starting out, we have this sense we're going to be talking about oppression, but we have the sense of the king is accountable. There is gain in the land. We are blessed when the king understands the need for work. Okay? And now I can talk about this freely and with no inhibitions because the election is over. Okay? So we don't have to talk about this in our politics. But then we get into verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This is also vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. Is that talking about gaining weight? And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Now, when you read these, unfortunately, because this is a book of wisdom, we tend sometimes to read wisdom books in the Bible as if the message on its face is the message. In other words, this is all about, you know, it's good to work. It's good for the king to understand work. If you look around, you notice that people who love money, they suffer because they end up, the more they love money, the less well they sleep because they have to worry about their money all the time. And indeed they should, because, I mean, it doesn't matter how you invest. If you invest in real estate, oh, that's been a good bet for the last couple of years. Invest in stocks, fine, until the dollar collapses, which we're doing everything in the fundamentals to kill off the dollar. You could lose a lot of sleep over investments. I hope nobody here does. But that's what Koheleth, the writer, the preacher of Ecclesiastes, is reminding us. And he says, sweet is the sleep of a laborer. He's basically saying, if you don't have this drive, this ambitious drive to accumulate and preserve everything you have, But basically, you quietly go about your business, doing the job, that the work that God puts in front of you, you're going to sleep a lot better than the person who has all kinds of responsibilities and especially all kinds of wealth to manage. Now, we can read this as if that's the message. It's, yeah, don't be too ambitious. That's the message on its surface, but Kehelet is not wasting our time with lame wisdom. Yeah, that's wisdom. It's not all that lame, but it's not real significant. It's not real profound. So let's read a little further. So we've read about no satisfaction. You could have too much wealth and not be satisfied. Now, no enjoyment, verses 13 to 17. There's a grievous evil I've seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. And those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is a father of a son, but now has nothing in his hand. And he came from his mother's womb. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again naked as he came, and take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This is often read at a funeral. This is also a grievous evil. That part isn't read at the funeral. They stop at verse 15. They don't go on and read 16, because when it's read at a funeral, it's supposed to be some kind of a comfort. Well, everybody is the same. We arrive on this earth naked. We leave on this earth naked. In other words, we take nothing with us, not even our clothing. What's the difference? Relax. It's just the way it is. It's life, the circle of life. And we're supposed to find some comfort in it. But verse 16, this is a grievous evil. Just as he came in, so shall he go. And what gain is there? So why bother with anything? You're born with nothing. You die with nothing. What's the difference? Forget it. And he says, that's evil. Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. He's referring back to the wealthy person who lost it all. And it's a reminder that no matter how much wealth we accumulate, we hold it very tenuously. It doesn't take much to have a calamity, a crisis, a financial crisis in our life or in the larger economy. It doesn't take much for it all to just drain away. It could be a debilitating illness. It could be something where we find ourselves in prison the rest of our lives. We commit a crime. It just doesn't take much. The difference between the person that is losing control as they're going into a crowd of people who are crossing, the difference between the person who is in prison for the rest of their life for manslaughter and the person who is not is a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second. And we cannot secure our lives. And so he's saying riches were kept by their owner to his hurt. The more we have, the more we have at risk to lose. Is everybody depressed yet? Have I got everyone? Yeah, have I got you where you need to be for this? So you can't really enjoy anything you have because, it's only there temporarily anyway. There's one right here if you'd like. Two over here. Thank you. You're welcome. Please, and you're so welcome. Okay. So we got no satisfaction, no enjoyment. If we're not depressed enough, let's get on with it and say, what's good? And this is Kehelet. He's walking us through this. Kehelet intends for you to be a little down at this moment as you're reading through this. That's the whole point. Because only when you get a dose of reality that you're ready for what he has to say. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. You know what? Just do the work God has put in front of you. Enjoy whatever blessing comes from that. And leave it at that. He's saying, actually, that's optimal. Anything other than that, not working at the work God puts in front of you is not optimal. Grabbing, 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 pushing, 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 pushing is not optimal. But there's kind of a golden mean. It's kind of a an optimal point where you accept the responsibilities and the work that God puts in front of you. You take on that work joyfully. You enjoy what comes out of it to the extent anything comes out of it. And what does he say? This is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and enjoy his toil. If God gives you a great amount, praise God. If God gives you a little bit, praise God. The lilies of the field, the birds of the air have their basic needs met. And that's what God asks us to do. He asks us to look at what he puts in front of us and expect from God that which he gives the lilies of the field and the birds of the air, clothing and food. Anything more than that is a gift from God. And if you if that's distant to you, if you and I, you or I are so used to all that we have, our house, our car, all that we have, then I recommend to you and to me mission trip therapy. Let's go find some Christians in another corner of the earth for whom a meal and some clothing is what they understand to be their grace from God, and they are grateful for it, and you ought to go to worship with them because their worship is the most joyful worship that you could ever find your way to. And that's basically what Koheleth is observing. For he will not much remember his days of his life because God keeps him occupied, pied with joy in his heart. So there, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, Rob. Exactly. Right.
Whenever someone is trying to teach you something.
Yeah. It's exactly right. Exactly right. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. This is a key. This is a key point. And so what the lesson is named up at the top, open-handedness. It's that we receive with an open hand that which God gives us. Now that open hand is also a working hand. But we receive that which God gives us. Now, I want to take that simple truth that is repeated for us, and we're to know that truth. But I want to push it a little bit. Because if we are, in a sense, too relaxed about this notion, I'm just going to work a little bit and then watch a lot of TV. I'm just going to push a little bit. You know, be not lazy. I'm not gonna. What does it take for me to not be a sluggard? You know, and dirt in my bed. Ah, oh.
Good.
Yeah, it feels good. Yeah, it does feel good. What does it take for me to not make that my lifestyle? Okay, so I want to do more than that, but I don't want to overdo it. Well, along the way, there is this notion of determinism that kind of underlies this. In the day of Jonathan Edwards in the 1700s, you had deists and you had theists and that were Calvinist, and you had theists who were Arminian. And there was this odd thing going on, a huge debate involving Jonathan Edwards and some other folks in Connecticut and Massachusetts in particular as part of in the aftermath of the First Great Awakening. And these folks found themselves on one side, and these folks found themselves on the other side. So you had this strange connection between deists who were fatalists, who believed that God was more or less, you know, like a watchmaker. He wound up the creation like a watch and let it go. And it's like one of those toys, you know, on the ground, you wind up and it just does whatever it does. And God just stands back and watches it, like we do in the mall. Sometimes we go by and there's these little dog things, you know, mechanical dogs. You know, we look at those. And that's how God wound up the universe. That's the deists, okay? The Calvinists also had a sense of God's engagement in the universe, but there wasn't like he stopped at one point, that he's still engaged. In fact, he's so engaged that everything that we have, everything that goes on in our life, even everything we do, is at least to some extent predetermined. It's that predestination that Paul talks about. And that's as opposed to the free will sort of movement in that same period of time, which said, no, wait a minute, God can't hold me responsible if by and large everything's already predetermined. And if we can't sort that out, then it's difficult for us to sort out what does it mean to take on the work that God has and to understand God's providence as we go through and we do our work. That notion of the deists, that determinism, if you turn your hand out over, there's a little cartoon there. It's actually a very old cartoon. It's a woodcut that goes back a ways. As you journey along the path, you meet an old man. He tells you that the modern, and that's modern as in enlightenment, could be a capital M, enlightenment period, 18th century, neuroscience, has proved that all of our actions and decisions are merely the machinations. I need my glasses. Let me grab my glasses. I can't read machinations. Machinations of a predetermined universe, and that our concept of free will is naught or nothing but a comforting illusion. If you agree with this, turn to page 72. If you disagree, turn to page 72. Why? Because you're going to page 72 anyway. It's been predetermined. Okay. A little 19th century humor there for you. Okay. All right. 18th century humor. Okay. So, this is an old Democritus, was an ancient Greek philosopher, Hobbes, Spinoza. Many others have held that every event in the universe is predetermined by a physical cause. If you think about it, if you or I were born in Chicago in the projects in the, say, the late 60s, and we grew up in the 70s there, where some of those projects were actually run by street gangs, okay? And you had a choice. You either got on board with the street gang that ran your apartment building, or what? Pretty much get killed. Those are your choices. So that meant you were now running drugs, selling drugs as a 12-year-old, as a 14-year-old growing up. I mean, this was your lot. You had no real choices in the matter. If you're born in Indonesia or Papua New Guinea, anybody here been to Papua New Guinea? Missionaries who go to Papua New Guinea have a tough time. Because in Papua New Guinea, like in much of Africa, the further out you go into smaller villages, the more you discover, what do the men do in the small villages? What do they do all day? Nothing.
I want to say hi first. Excuse me. Hi, everybody. Yeah. I'm a woman of God, and I came from Africa. So
yes.
I'm the best to tell you the
yes,
story.
You are. Thank
yes,
you.
So, because, you know, I'm here for a long time in America. So I learn, I watch TV, and I'm not for what this is shown TV.
Right.
Because I'm not white.
Right.
Because I know who I am. Okay, in the village, men, they are very strong,
mm-hmm.
because they can kill a lion,
mm-hmm.
so you have to be strong, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to be David to do that.
Right.
So they are strong, they have farms, they have cars, they have everything. But in my village, I can say, because I'm born in a village, my pastor, my mother, and my mom, they are pastors for the Salvation Army.
Mm.
So I have a loved one.
Mm.
And the loved one God saved.
Mm.
Maybe the snake would kill me when I was born because my mother didn't have the time to bring me to the hospital.
Mm.
So she had to give me birth.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was the one who was a doctor on that day.
Mm-hmm.
But my father was a major of the Salvation, a big officer.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to save me.
Mm.
Nobody. No hospital.
Right.
He didn't have the time because he was working
mm-hmm.
for God at the
mm-hmm.
church.
Mm-hmm.
And my mm-hmm. mother was ready to give me birth. Mm-hmm. So I can say, in the village, men, they are very, very strong.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have cars.
Mm-hmm.
And the 1 kilometer to kilometer, they walk.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, I know that's the way it was in your village because you were there and you tell us that. But we know that sometimes when missionaries go to Papua New Guinea and some of the areas around Indonesia, and we hear the same thing in some parts of Africa, is that the men in Papua New Guinea, missionary goes there, in order to witness to the men, the missionary basically has to sit in the middle of the village with the men for days and days and days and days. Because that's what they do all day. And then where are the women? They're doing the work. And so if you were born in Papua New Guinea, if you were a man, you would be expected to go through whatever process to become recognized as a man. Then you would find yourself largely sitting on a rug in the middle of the village. What I'm saying is God deposits us in different cultures in different parts of the world, and wherever we are, that's certainly going to have an influence on what our options are. And so those who are determinists would say, well, there you go. If you are an evangelical Christian, whether in Africa or in any part of the world, it's because all of the stars lined up, all of the activities lined up to put you in that place, and it was just going to happen that way. But if they didn't, then you would not. That's determinism. And in the Bible, we kind of have a tension between determinism and predestination versus responsibility for how we respond, especially to the gospel. And that's that tension is actually reflected in the Westminster Confession. If you look at 4:1 next to the cartoon, in section 3.1, it says, God did ordain whatsoever comes to pass. But you read a little bit later, just like in the Bible, and it says that man's will is neither forced nor by any absolute necessity of nature determined to good or evil. So it's both and, both predestination and responsibility for choice. And that's difficult for Enlightenment type philosophers to get their arms around it, which is why they had so many debates about it. Jonathan Edwards actually worked through this, and to really understand Jonathan Edwards' understanding of it, it's helpful to recognize Jonathan Edwards' philosophy. And I apologize for skipping some of the Bible verses that we already went past, but if you have 1 Timothy 1:17, if you could read that, please. Yes, please.
To the King of the ages, immortal, invisible, the only God, be honor and glory forever and ever.
One of the things that we're doing here at Cornerstone for our ABFs is that over the next years we're going to be going in and out of some common material that all the ABFs will be doing. And one of those common materials is biblical theology. And in biblical theology, we spent some time thinking about the attributes of God. When Jonathan Edwards ran across this verse, we heard this verse, he realized that packed in this verse is so much sovereignty to the King of the ages. In other words, from eternity to eternity, God is King. Immortal, not dying, invisible, not bound by natural materialism. Not bound by electrons and protons and neutrons. Transcending all of that. The only God, the one God, the one source of everything, be honor. May we honor him. May we understand and extend glory. And may we do that forever. When he saw this, it opened up for him a whole sense of how grand and how big God is. And when that happened, it made him realize that his teeny little fly speck of a world was under a huge amount of sovereignty by a great God. And that informed his whole understanding of the gospel. his most famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Has anybody ever heard or read that sermon? Anybody here? I recommend it to you. You can find it on the internet. Just type in Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. It's based on Deuteronomy 32, a small portion of Deuteronomy 32, 35. If you have that, if you could please read that. When their foot shall slip, their doom comes swiftly. Jonathan Edwards' sermon is, and he describes it, it's like trying to cross a chasm, actually trying to cross over a bridge over hell by walking on a rotten canvas. And there are tiny little fibers that are keeping you from dropping down into hell. And he describes that in the sense of that's how dependent we are for Jesus Christ. And we have the bridge illustration. Jesus Christ is a bridge to God. But that's how dependent we are upon him. We are absolutely entitled. There's nothing we can do. We're going to to cross. We have to take that step out onto that tiny little rotten fiber and trust Jesus Christ. And that is his sense of how great and how sovereign is that God ultimately decides whether we cross or not by our regeneration, our response to the gospel. So he wrote a book. This is the title of the book. This is actually the title of the book, A Careful and Strict Inquiry into the Modern Prevailing Notions of the Freedom of Will. That's the name of the book. Okay. It's referred to informally as Freedom of Will. And he took on this whole question about predetermination, about determinism and predestination. And he basically observed in this book that we have what he calls a natural necessity. We have natural needs, desires, wants that we respond to. And to the extent that those are, as we would read in the New Testament, the lust of the eyes and the desires of the flesh, whether it's food, clothing, coveting anything we see, to the extent that we have it, we want it, we need it. That's how we want to go through life. And he refers to that, it's almost, as Koheleth refers to, it's almost animalistic. It's just simply responding to what we see and what we want and what we think we need, and we go through life and we kind of grab what we can, and that's as good as it's going to get. But he says we also have a moral necessity. And this is wired into us, this sense of who am I and why am I here. It's what people after Jonathan would call an existential need, what Viktor Frankl would call a need for meaning in life. And that we have this, and there's a tension between getting, and wanting to have honor, wanting to be able to honor myself, to respect myself, to think well of myself. If I just take, I don't think well of myself. And so there's this tension. And by God's grace, by saving grace, God enables us to have moral necessity that has any hope at all. Because without God, without Jesus Christ, moral necessity is doomed. It is a failure. And that whole book, which is available, I've got the link down at the bottom. You can search for it. It's also available online, A Careful and Strict Inquiry in Freedom of Will. It's built on Romans 9:16. If you have Romans 9:16, if that's your yellow bookmark, if you could back it up to Romans 9:14 and read 14 to 16, please.
What shall we say then? Is there justice on God's part? Is there injustice on God's part? By no means. For he says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. So then it depends not on human will or exertion, but on God who has mercy.
And I really like that you said, is there justice? Is there justice on God's part? Is there injustice? It's really both. We ask both. Is there justice? Is there injustice? At the end of the day, God says to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I have mercy. I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. So Timothy is quoting the Old Testament. And the conclusion is, so then it depends not on human will or exertion, but upon God who has mercy. At the end of the day, mercy and grace is 100% God and 0% me. So as we look at, if you still have Ecclesiastes 5 open, as we look at that, at those verses, those last three verses, especially the last verse, for he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. God does put us here with a purpose. This is really the whole point of the book of Ecclesiastes. It starts out, vanity, vanity, all is vanity, all is vapor, all is mist, all is purposelessness, all is futility. It just doesn't matter. We're born, we die, it doesn't matter. We disappear into the dust. It doesn't matter. But as he works through that, as Koheleth works through that, as he unfolds that and he explores it and he asks questions about it, he discovers things. This is a discovery. He discovers, you know what? Wait a minute. God puts work in front of us. He puts a task in front of us. And that's grace number one. Grace number two, he gives us some meaning anyway by letting us have something from that task. Maybe it's something to eat and something to wear. Maybe it's more than that. He gives us dominion over some food and some clothing, and for most of us, for all of us in this room, even more than that. So now we have two things. Number one, we realize our ability to work, our opportunity to work, our reward from work, all three of those are entirely God's grace. All three. Our ability, our opportunity, our reward. All come from God. So he says, so there you have it. There's some joy there. Let that joy that comes from just being sustained, that's meaningful. Allow it to force your eyes upward to the sustainer who, is the creator and the sustainer. And when we do that, then all of a sudden we begin to take on some concern, as in last week, some fear. Wait a minute, that's pretty scary stuff. I was created and I'm being sustained by God? Yikes! I need to get that thing figured out because I was created and I'm even being sustained every minute of my life by God. And that forces us to the person and the work of Jesus Christ. Because it is through the person and the work of Jesus Christ that we have the audacity, that we have the ability, that we have the opportunity to actually have fellowship with God. God is not a blind watchmaker, and creation is not a machination or a mechanism. It is an expression of a person. And through Jesus Christ, we get to have a relationship with that person. 1 John 4:19, if you have it, please.
We love because he first loved us.
Father God in heaven, thank you for love. Thank you for grace. Thank you for work. Thank you for food and clothing. Thank you for the gospel. Thank you for the cross. Allow us now to worship in complete gratitude. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.